Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Carl Kennedy from The Rising, and listen to Talking Metal.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel of the Talking Metal Podcast, and on today's show, we welcome back Carl Kennedy of The Rods. He is here to talk about his new project, St. James, his new band, I guess I'd call it St. James, and we also talk about Lemmy, we talk about, of course, The Rods, and we talk about Anthrax, and we also talk about, believe it or not, Scientology. So we will be getting into that interview in just a bit. But first, let me check in with my co-host for this episode, a guy who hasn't been on the show in a while, and I'm glad he's finally back with us, Victor Ruiz. How are you, Victor?
I'm doing good, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I've had a handful of emails or tweets, or I think there's even a Facebook review, or not Facebook, iTunes review, where people mention you, and somebody in an email said they missed that you weren't on the show, and I started thinking about it, and I was like, I miss not having Victor on the show too, so we got to get him back. So I'm glad you are back for this episode. And what have you been up to lately? Can you fill us in on what's happening with you podcast wise?
Sure. I mean, I'm still doing Mars Attacks. We haven't had an episode out in a few weeks, but that's because of server difficulties more than anything. There should be a new episode out this week.
Cool.
Also been doing another show called Galaxy of Geeks, which is all sci-fi related stuff.
I heard two episodes of that, and I was pretty impressed. I really liked what you guys were doing, and thought that it was just a good discussion. The guy you do the show with, he's in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, he's actually in Rockaway, New Jersey. Somebody that I went to college with, actually, that I hooked up actually sort of by accident. He was mentioned on an episode of Decibel Geek Podcast, and I sent him a direct tweet and said, "Hey, are you the Chris Vaglio that went to, you know, CCM during this year or whatever?" And we reconnected, and
wow,
a few months.
World.
Yeah, absolutely. And then a few months back, I said, you know, I'd I'd really like to do a show that touches upon all these different things that I'm into that has nothing to do with music, all these series and movies and different things. And he was down with it. And the idea was, we originally started out with four hosts, and it's almost impossible to get the four of us together. So usually it's the two of us, or at least one of the two of us, with some other guest. And he's also a he owns a small, I mean, I don't know how you would call it, a production company that makes commercials, and they do shorts and things of that nature. They actually just won an award this weekend down in Atlantic City for a short that they did called The White Spruce that was shot up all in Morris County. Nice. So,
and tell us the name of the podcast you do with him again.
It is called Galaxy of Geeks.
And where can people find it online?
Yeah, they could find it on iTunes, or you could go to the homepage, which is galaxyofgeeks.net.
Nice. So, I was out at a bar last night with some friends, and man, just spent like an hour talking about Star Wars. So maybe you and I will come back and talk a little bit about that before we wrap up today's episode. But right now, I want to actually get into some music. This is Madhouse by Anthrax, off the Spreading the Disease album, an album that was produced, or at least co-produced, by today's guest, Carl Kennedy, of the Rods fame. So here we go, a little Madhouse by Anthrax.
I live.
What you just heard was Madhouse by Anthrax off the Spreading the Disease record, a record that I really love. I mean, I think my two favorite Anthrax records are Spreading the Disease and, you know, Among the Living. And I really like most of their catalog. I know you're a big fan of Anthrax too, right, Victor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll be quite honest. I lean more towards the years that John Bush was in the band.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as the original run with Joey, I would say that Spreading the Disease is my second favorite out of that run. I would say Persistence of Time is my first, but it all has to do with when, you know, with a lot of these albums, when it connects with you emotionally and everything. And I mean, those were albums that were going on during my high school years and things that were, you know, behind when they may have connected with you. So
right on. You know, it's a great song. I actually just had the disc in my car and was cranking it. It's A Random Acts of Senseless Violence off the Stomp 442 record. That record, you know, at the time when it came out, I really didn't dig it that much because it sounded like they were trying so hard to be something that they weren't. But now that I go back with fresh ears many years later, you know, I was partly inspired by Scott Ian's book, reading about the production of that record, you know, and I went back and kind of rediscovered it. I really think there's some great stuff on that record. Was that a record that hit you strongly when it in a positive light when it first was released back in, 1990? I'm trying to think when that, probably 95, I think.
Yeah, it was around there, 94, 95, I think. Yeah, that makes sense. That song and Fueled was the first thing that I heard, which was the first single.
Right.
And those two songs are, I think, some of their best in their catalog.
Right.
The rest of the album, similar to what you said, initially it took me a while to get into some of the tracks, but going back and listening to their catalog not that long ago, and I mean, I do that maybe like once a year. I'll go back and hit absolutely everything by them and other artists. And it really has a lot of like darker songs, things that sound different, but at the same time are still really heavy. If you really think about it, a lot of people seem to say, well, that's, you know, it's a grunge album, or it really doesn't fit this or it doesn't fit that. I mean, it's almost cool that it doesn't do that, that it isn't a second attempt at, you know, Among the Living or something like that, or even Sound of White Noise. It's almost
it's a progression, which, or definitely goes somewhere a little different than Sound of White Noise, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, good stuff. And you know, while we're here, why don't we hit that song right now? Because it is a good one. The one you mentioned, Fueled, off of the Stomp 442 record by Anthrax, going back to 1995. Music written by Charlie, lyrics by Scott and John. This is 90s era Anthrax with Fueled.
I like to forget why I feel this compulsion.
just heard was Fueled by Anthrax, and I am joined here by Victor Ruiz, co-host and host of numerous podcasts, including Mars Attacks and Galaxy of Geeks. Right, Victor?
That's it. Yep.
Cool. Where can people get in touch with you on online?
Twitter and
Facebook.
Yeah, Twitter would be just VMR907 is probably the easiest because that's like the generic way of reaching me without going through one of the show Twitters. And I'm up there on Facebook, and it's actually the exact same thing, facebook.com/VMR907.
Excellent. This is a band called St. James. It features Carl Kennedy on drums, and the song is called Worth Fighting For. I think this is good stuff. The album's called Resurgence, and Carl is going to tell us all about St. James. So let's check out this song. Go support St. James, buy their stuff legally online or on, you know, on Amazon or at the CD store, however you get your music. And yeah, stay tuned for my interview following this song with Carl Kennedy. And again, this song is Worth Fighting For by St. James. He's got a secret. Mark Striegel of the Talking Metal Podcast, and joining us on the line we have Carl Kennedy, and he is known mostly for his music with the Rods, but that track we just heard was called Worth Fighting For, a great track. I really love it. It's by the band St. James, and Carl is also the drummer in St. James. Hey Carl, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mark. Good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you. We had you on the show back in late 2004, and we really went into a lot of the Rods' history and
all about that great band. So I wanted to hit a couple other topics in this interview today. We'll definitely get an update on the Rods from you. But let's start with St. James. I got the record sent over to me, the new album, Resurgence. And very impressive, very somewhat different from the Rods, I would say. And I just wanted to talk to you about this band or project. I'm not exactly sure how you're envisioning it. Can you fill us in a little bit about St. James and the history?
You know, St. James, I started a production company with Gary Dallaire and my now deceased good friend Charles Sanofsky. And we started a recording studio and a production company. So I was, the Rods were on hiatus. I was looking for bands to produce, and I was also looking for a band, you know, a project. I was really, the Rods were really inactive. Everybody was off doing their own thing. And St. James came in onto my radar, and they found us and sent us some recordings. And so, you know, in listening to them, I thought, oh, this band really has something. So I said, let's bring them in, and brought them into the studio. And as it turned out, and I love them, and I love them as people. I thought they were great songwriters, great musicians. They had a problem. They didn't have a drummer. So I thought, right. Hey, this is a great opportunity for me as well, so producing them. But initially, and let me back up a little bit, they had a drummer. But the drummer was, first of all, he was, and I'm not being disparaging in any way, but he wasn't as strong as the other guys. And I don't know that I should say wasn't as strong. I don't think that he was dialed into their music the okay. way they were hoping he would be. So we did pre-production with him, and he got the flu. He came down with the flu. And subsequently, I wound up with the flu. Deathly ill. My friend called it dengue fever. Bob Acquaviva wow. manages a band, Wicked, which should check out Wicked if you get a chance.
Okay.
Band. Kind of a retro thing with a modern, you know, twist on things, but cool band.
All right.
But Bob took care of me while I was sick. I was just dying. His family would bring me food. I finally went to the hospital. So once I recovered, we were out of time. The guys had to go. I was, you know, we're running out of studio time because at the time I was sharing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off with the building owner before I bought a building. So we were running out of time. We had a day left. So the drummer had gone. He was so sick, he had gone home long before. So I came in and played drums on the first album, and I knocked it out in a day. Fortunately, we'd done pre-production. I knew all the songs, knew the arrangements, and because I was involved in all of that. And that's kind of how it went. So they needed a drummer, wanted me to play live. I mean, I just had production duties, so unable to do that. And so we just kept recording. And so as time went on, I was always the drummer. And they would just use drummers live. And, you know, we're hoping that if we got a recording contract, you know, we could go do dates. And sadly, we were close so many times and just couldn't land a good deal. And then, you know, so it turned out that we just really never wound up doing dates. We just couldn't go out on the road with them. And it just became a little secret, you know.
Right.
Nobody knew it was my project with the band. And, but, you know. I'm hoping now that it's out, we're talking about possibly doing some dates, which I'm really excited about.
And who are the guys in the band? You got John on vocals, right? And who else is in the band with you?
Bob and Jim. Bob is guitar, or Bob is bass guitar. Jim's lead and rhythm guitar, and those two are brothers, and me.
Cool. Excellent. Yeah. So dates aren't firmed up yet. You're kind of waiting for the album. Is the album out at this point, or is it going to be released?
It's going to be released, and I can't announce it yet. But we're in final negotiations with a label.
Okay.
So, hallelujah! The band finally has a label.
Excellent. Well, exciting stuff. And again, we heard one of the tracks here, Worth Fighting For. And it's a big record. It's got a lot of tracks, and they're all really, really good. How would you describe the difference musically between, say, like St. James and what you do with the Rods?
I think that the Rods is really, we're really a musical band, but the Rods are just so high energy. Whereas St. James is more musical in the studio, but very high energy live. You know, they're a great show live, and they're really energetic live. But in the studio, the songs are more involved, I would say, and you know, possibly more melodic. John's a great singer and able to take the songs places that we probably don't do vocally with the Rods. Even though David and I write that way, so in, you know, but for the Rods itself, if you notice, our solo albums have different melody lines. So I think that's the big difference between the two bands. But that's what I love about St. James. Jimmy is the main songwriter in the band, although, you know, everybody contributes, but he's such a great songwriter. I mean, he's so prolific as well. I mean, we have so much more material. So
cool. Well,
yeah.
Is there, I was poking around online trying to find out information about the band St. James. And I got to tell you, it was a little hard for me to come up with very much information. Is there a website set up yet, do you know, or a Facebook page?
There is a Facebook page. There's a St. James Facebook page. So people can go to that.
Okay. All right. Yeah, give it a like. I will find out what that is, and I'll have it. This is for the listeners. I'll have that linked through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com, so we can all go over and give it a like and get acquainted with St. James, which has some really strong music. I wanted to talk to you about earlier this year a Lemmy tribute that you were involved with for. It was the cover of Ace of Spades. Can you tell us a little bit about who was involved in that and how it came about?
You know, years ago, I did an album called Thrasher, and I'd been a fan of TKO, and I love Brad Sinsel's voice. So Brad came in and did a couple of tracks for the Thrasher album he sang, and we became friends, and we've remained friends all these years. And when Lemmy died, Brad wanted to do a tribute. So the TKO guys wanted to do something. They asked me if I would be interested in joining them on drums, which I was thrilled to do. And that's how it came about. I mean, it's Bryn Ahrens and Rick Pierce and Evan Shealy, and of course, Brad Sinsel and myself. And it was something we did quickly and just, you know, because we all loved Lemmy and Motorhead.
Yeah.
Very sad that he's gone, but you know.
Did you know Lemmy? Did you know him personally?
You know, we did a date with Motorhead once, and Lemmy hung out after, and you know, he was just the nicest guy. I think Lemmy, the thing that I liked the most about Lemmy and respect the most about Lemmy is that he was the real deal, you know. And I mean, that was the thing with Lemmy. Like, I remember us actually being, well, first of all, they were the loudest freaking band. I mean, they were so loud. They were, when we finished our set, I was outside with fans, and we were doing our live album at that time. I was talking to the engineer, and we were outside, and we were yelling at each other because they were so loud outside the venue, the Calderon Theater. They were still loud outside. It was like, wow, these guys are loud.
Wow.
And it's not like the Rods are shy, you know, about volume. Like I would say, David playing an acoustic guitar is deafening for most people.
Right, right.
You know, but he came out after and you know, hung out. And the guy was just so genuine. And he was great with the fans. And, you know, he's really sweet. He's standing with his arm around me. And we'd never met. He was just the kind, nice guy, very intelligent. And you know, I just have heard and seen that till the day he died, he was the same guy, you know. My friends I know
right
talked to him, we'd walk up to him, and everybody has the same story. It's like the same about, you know, Lonnie James Deal, you know. I interviewed about Lonnie after his death, and the interviewer said, after the interview, he said, I was hoping you'd have something bad to say. He said, Vivian Campbell's the only one who's ever had anything bad to say about Lonnie. I was hoping to find more of a balance because everybody just raves about him. I think that's how it was with Lemmy. But
yeah,
it was a thrill to work with those guys, and we're actually collaborating on some other material, so that's fun.
Oh, cool. Cool, exciting. And, you know, you mentioned the Rods and David. What are you guys currently up to? What's the status of the Rods?
We are leaving April 21st, heading to Amsterdam, and they're doing the Very Heavy Sound in Stadskanaal, which we're excited about. John Roth and the Roz were headlining. And then we travel to Lübeck and hang out with our friends, Dirk Horman, and then we're going to travel to Hamburg, and we're going to do a date in Hamburg, and trying to find them as we're speaking what dates they are. And then we go to Keep It True, and they play Keep It True. So that's, those are some European dates we're doing this coming month.
Cool. And I recently completed reading Scott Ian's book, and I wanted to first ask you if you've read the book.
You know, I have not read the book, and it's not something, it's something I would like to do. I just have not gotten around to doing it.
Well, you know, you're in the book, obviously, and he credits you, really, as the guy who brought Joey Belladonna to Anthrax, which really was probably a decision and a thing that changed the band's career for the better. Can you talk about where you knew Joey from and how you ended up bringing him into the Anthrax fold?
Well, it was mentioned in the Thrasher album, which Andrew Duff McDonald and I wrote together. And Andrew, of course, is was the guitarist for Blue Cheer, Shaken Street, Savoy Brown. And, you know, we're still very, very good friends. Anthrax was in the studio, and after Neil, they had gone off on tour. We had done the first album with Anthrax, Fistful of Metal. And
when you say we, you were producing and
I produced, right, working with the band. So they had gone off on tour, so now it came time to come back into the studio. And at that point, it was no more Neil, and now they had a new singer. And the new singer, we spent a week, and I worked with him and really tried hard. And this is where I think that over the years, I've worked with a lot of bands and worked with a lot of musicians. And it's like anything. I guess after a while, you just kind of know the ones who have it and the ones who don't have it. And it was clear that Anthrax was the quote-unquote band who had it. And one of the things that, I mean, I knew that from day one, but I knew this even more so, that they had that go for the throat, you know, we're going to make it no matter what attitude. When after a week in the studio, the singer, he was just young. He was not ready for this. He was just not up to the task on a number of levels. So when I pointed it out to the guys and said, "Is that going to be the band that's taking you to the singer? It's going to take you to the major label." They said, "Get Johnny on the phone." And I got John Zazula on the phone and told him what was up. And he said, "Let me talk to the guys." And the guys went into the conference room, and 5 minutes later they came out and said, "John wants to talk to you." John said, "Put him on a bus." So now I came out and I had to tell the poor guy, who was very, very upset and, you know, certainly not the kind of task you relish having to do.
But, right.
You know, but so now we're in the studio and they have no singer, and they're hoping to get a major label deal, and they have no singer, and the clock's ticking and they have nothing. So we started looking for singers, and I called Andrew Duck McDonald, and he's always been really great at finding singers. He found Rick Caudle for our Hollywood album, and he said, "You know, let me give Joey a call." So got Joey and asked Joey to come in, and the guys, you know, they heard him and they were blown away immediately. It was such an obvious fit, the synergy and the chemistry. So
definitely,
the rest, as they say, is history, you know.
Yeah, and with working with Anthrax back in those days, you know, in Scott's book, it sounds like initially it was a very positive experience, at least the way he puts it. But then towards the end, I wanted to give you a chance to defend yourself. He says things kind of started souring, and that he accuses you of not being at the studio as much as they wanted you to be. And at one point, he says that you approached the band and actually asked them to come help out around your house. You needed help cutting the grass. And is this true? Do you remember this?
That's the first I've heard of that. I don't recall ever having asked them to do that. You know, I've heard some of these things over the years, and, you know, I've really tried to stay away from some of the negativity. I will say that that was absolutely not true. To my memory, I don't ever remember asking the band to come to the house. And I think this was the confusion, and this is what happens. I want to say it's the pearls before swine. They were young.
Right.
I don't think they realized that Joey, and also I wanted to say the other thing that they didn't realize. They felt that there was a lot of time passing, but they brought in Frank. Frank had never played in the studio. Now, remember, Dan Roker had been in the band.
Yes.
Now they brought in Frank Bello, and Frank's a great guy, and he was a great bass player, but Frank was young and inexperienced. So there, and the same with Joey. Joey wasn't used to fast tempos and the timing. You know, it was something he was getting used to. And it was taking time, and I was trying to buy him time. And my mistake in that, in hindsight, was not saying to the band, you know, your bass player needs a lot of time. You just brought in a bass player who's really green, and, you know, you're asking him to play this album and for us to make this as tight and as clean as we want. Take him time. And it's the same with the singer. We've got to give them some time to adjust. And they really didn't get that, you know? They really didn't get that. And I think that, and I also don't think they realized some of the things that I did for them. I paid their per diems. Johnny had no money at the time. He was struggling. You know, he had money in the pipeline, but he had no money. I have a book of the Anthrax per diems that I paid out of my pocket.
Right.
Several thousand dollars. You know, there were things that I did for the band I don't think they were aware of at the time. And I think that it was, you know, toward the end, they were unhappy, but I certainly don't recall asking them to mow my grass, nor would I have expected them to mow my grass. They were young and very headstrong, and they were full of themselves, you know? I mean, there was a young arrogance to them that was something that was really gave them the drive and the attitude they needed to succeed. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes that arrogance is what motivates you. It's what keeps you going in spite of, you know, daunting odds. You know, you just forge ahead, screw everybody. So,
right.
I mean, but it's honestly the first time I've ever addressed any of that. I just tried to stay away from it.
Right. And you know what, in Scott's defense, most of what he says about you in the book is in my opinion, quite positive, especially he totally gives you credit in bringing the amazing Joey Belladonna into the fold. And, but he does also say that you ask them to come cut the grass at your house. So, yeah, enough of that. Last time you were on the podcast, we were talking about a song that is off of your Headbanger record, which I really like, and I want to play it for the Talking Metal listeners again today, called The Cult of the Poison Mind. And you said something in the interview that I never really followed up on when you said it. This is back in 2014. You told me that this song, again, which we're going to hear in a few minutes here, it was partly inspired by when you were almost indoctrinated into Scientology. And I wanted to just go there a little bit, because I find that fascinating. And is it, can you go into a little more detail about how that almost happened or did happen?
Well, I was living in, I think it started in LA, kind of got getting recruited, and then somebody said, read Dianetics. So I read Dianetics. And, you know, certainly, I mean, I'm not disparaging or criticizing anyone's religion, but it certainly had elements of science fiction, religion, psychology, you know, all kind of mishmash together. And
a lot of Dianetics makes sense, right? That's what I've heard, that, you know, it can suck people in when you read that book.
No, I think that's right. That's right. And it is there are elements in there. And to one extent, you know, I don't know. But anyway, so that was the case. When I was living in New Jersey, started going and to some meetings and doing some of the sessions, like bull baiting and, you know, some of the things that they did. And, you know, you just, it's a level thing with Scientology. So it was all interesting. And then we had a friend who was very high up in Scientology. He had gone clear, quote unquote, which is a very high level of consciousness, high state of consciousness that you achieve over a number of courses. And of course, each course is successively more expensive. So it's a very costly thing to go clear for Scientology. And so he was very much all about Scientology, of course. And at that point, it kind of struck me as, and it wasn't that I was really being drawn into it because we had stopped it, but at that point, it really became clear to me.
Right.
No pun intended, but it was clear to me that it was not for me and that it did have a certain cult-like mentality to it. And then again, I'm not trying to bash Scientology. I'm just saying that my perspective of it was that it was something more involved than something than I cared to get into. It was a little more regimented and a little more dogma than I cared to be a part of.
Right on, right on. You know, it's interesting because I've heard that Billy Sheehan is a Scientologist and has to be one of the nicest guys I've ever met. So I guess whatever works for you, you know.
I think there are some great things about it, you know, and I think Billy is a super positive, the nicest guy, and incredibly talented. And you know, I mean, there's so many Scientologists who are highly successful. So, you know, it's whatever works for you, like you said. I agree.
Cool. Well, on that note, we're going to get into that song, which is a little over a year old, right? When did your Headbanger record come out?
Came out November of 2014, so right. Just over a year ago.
Right on. And it is the Carl Kennedy solo record, Headbanger. Who plays on that record with you?
A number of great people. John Hahn did almost all the guitar work. Chris Caffrey does some solo work. Mark Tornillo sings three songs and just killed it. Joe Camo sings. Dave Porter from 805.
Wow, good lineup.
Gary Chesick, Nolan Ayers. There's so many people, so many friends who contributed to the album. Thrilled. Yeah, really grateful to all of them.
Good stuff. And we encourage the Talking Metal listeners to check out Resurgence by St. James featuring Carl Kennedy, and we're going to have links up to the Facebook page for St. James in today's show notes. And right now, this is Cult of the Poison Mind off the 2014 Carl Kennedy solo record, Headbanger. Carl, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Metal.
Mark, great to talk to you as always.
Cool. The outside world!
cult of the boys and mine. Leave your will and your thoughts so far behind. As you enter the cult of the boys and mine.
There was called Cult of the Poison Mind, and interesting to hear from Carl, once toyed with Scientology, so he told us a little bit about that at the end of the interview there, Victor, and that song, Cult of the Poison Mind, is actually off of his solo record, Headbanger, which came out in late 2014, so there you go, and a big thanks to Carl for joining us and setting the record straight. He believes he never asked Scott Ian to go cut his grass, which is what Scott Ian says in the book. So there you have it. It's funny, you know, memories tend to take on their own life for different people. And it's even in my life, like I know there's friends of mine who I've known for decades, like John Astronomy, for example. Like we both have different memories and ideas of things that we did together like years ago, and so who knows who's right on that, you know, but Scott's book is a great read and I highly recommend it, co-written by a friend of mine, John Wiederhorn. So yeah, check out I'm the Man by Scott Ian. It's a great book. And also check out St. James, Carl Kennedy's new band that he's working with. Resurgence is the name of their record. So Victor, I you know, you mentioned your Galaxy of Geeks podcast. How often do the new episodes come out?
Usually every 2 weeks.
Cool. And what has been, I know there was a Star Wars one, which I actually, I think gave you a quote for or something that you did right after The Force Awakens premiered. What other topics have you hit?
Star Wars is probably the main theme because right. Everyone involved is such a big, you know, Star Wars fan. We did an episode last night, which was just released today, on the season finale of The Walking Dead.
Okay.
We did, well, we are going to do stuff like all the comic book movies that are coming out this year, which are going to be like 7 or 8 different comic book movies. When Game of Thrones comes out, we'll get into that as well.
Good, good and stuff. Did you see Batman versus Superman?
I have not.
Yeah, okay. I'm curious. I thought it was okay. You know, I actually, I'll go on record saying I really enjoyed it. I honestly did.
Okay.
However, again, I was hanging with these people last night, and the one guy who's a big DC guy just said it was horrific and the worst thing he'd ever seen, and just absolutely shameful. So, I you know, and just he was so passionate about it that I didn't really know what to say. He was offended that I had even, you know, considered it to be entertaining. And I like I said, I kind of liked it. I thought it was good. It's definitely a little long, but you know, the Star Wars stuff is always a great thing to discuss. And you know, while I have you here, you know, to get a little off topic here, you know, off the metal, off the rock music, what do you think of some of the storylines? I wanted to specifically get into the, you know, the Supreme Leader Snoke, right? Am I saying that right? Snoke?
Snoke.
The Supreme Leader Snoke. Yeah. What are your thoughts on him? Because I've heard so many theories about who he may or may not be. And I just started reading, well, I didn't just start, I'm over halfway through it, but the novelization of The Force Awakens, and it has some additional info on him. One bit of info, which I don't really see too many people grabbing hold of online, which I think is just huge, that he is not human, you know. So all these theories, oh, well, maybe he is Darth Vader because he has the scar, like, on his head, or maybe he is, you know, one of the kids that was murdered at the what was it, the Jedi Temple? Is that where it was back on in episode 3? Maybe he's one of those kids. It kind of blows all those theories out of the water, because it refers to him as humanoid but not human in the Force Awakens novel. And there's also, you know, they included the full script in the novel. I guess now the deleted scenes are being released, actually were released yesterday.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot like that where he where Snook, Snook or Snook? I'm having like a Snook, right? Snook?
Snoke, like
Snoke.
Smoke.
Snoke, right. Snoke, when Snoke and Ren, you know, and Hux is there too, and then he leaves, and then Snoke says to Ren, there's been an awakening, have you felt it? And, you know, Ren says, you know, says yes, and they go into this conversation. But in the book, and I'm guessing it was in the original script too, there's a lot of, after Hux leaves the room, there's a lot more dialogue between Ren and Snoke, who basically throws Vader under the bus and says the whole reason the Empire failed was because Vader screwed it up and let these emotions and sentiment for his son come back into his being, into his mind, and that if Vader could have avoided that the Empire never would have never fallen. And so some interesting info coming back coming through in the book, and this, I especially found it interesting that they're saying that he is not a human. Have you any theories on who he might be?
I mean, with you telling me that, I mean, that's gonna throw the door wide open for it to be Sidious, which a lot of people have talked about,
right? Sidious. Okay, so Palpatine, you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Palpatine was human, wasn't he?
But maybe if you're saying that he's not human, maybe that was similar to Vader. That's almost a reconstructed version of him, or maybe similar to how there are Force ghosts. Maybe that's him from the afterlife or whatever.
Right. Could be. It seems like he would be more like, I don't know, like some sort of like, because to me, even Vader is still human, even though he's been rebuilt. I mean, I don't. It refers to him as humanoid. I don't know what the definition of humanoid is. I'd have to look that up. But
yeah, I mean, it's interesting with going back and seeing a lot of things that I hadn't before, or even the one animated series they have now, Rebels. It seems as if they're trying to almost fill in all these gaps between what Lucas left open and what Disney is now trying to do with the new storylines. So it'll be interesting to see how Rogue One plays into all of this.
Right. I heard now Vader is in Rogue One. Have you heard that?
Yes. Yeah. I've heard that. And Vader's in the animated series Rebels as well. He's appeared in, I think it's two or three episodes.
Right. Now I've seen like the first three of season one. I haven't kept up on it. It seemed a little hokey to me, but I'm going to try to give it another look, because I heard that the season two really does pick up, and that I heard the season two finale is quite awesome. So I need to definitely get on that.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It definitely picked up with definitely with how the characters have evolved and just their different roles, and how a lot of them are trying to almost pull apart from the nucleus that started out in the beginning. So it's interesting how they also, like I said, weave in all these different factors that are really left open between the prequels and between, you know, the original Star Wars movie with New Hope. So, I mean, I don't know, how does... I've asked this before on Galaxy of Geeks. How does the animated series ultimately play into Rogue One, for example? There anything that feeds into that? Are there any characters that are mentioned? Are there any characters that are, you know, the offspring of some of the other characters? Because one of the characters, and I forget his name, that dies at the beginning of Force Awakens, he's the guy that gives the plans to...
He's like Sir... it's like Sir Takia or something like that. I know who you mean.
Yeah, he's supposedly in Rogue One.
Okay, that would make sense. Victor, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Lost you there.
I dropped out there for a second. Yeah.
You were mentioning the guy, the older character from the beginning of Force Awakens, who is in going to be in Rogue One.
Yeah.
You said he's supposedly, and then you dropped out.
Okay. So supposedly the character that gives Poe Dameron the missing link to find Luke, he supposedly, or at least is rumored, to be one of the rebels that's in Rogue One that steals the original Death Star plans.
Okay.
So he's supposed to be the arc between both stories.
Right. And his character, by the way, is Lor San Tekka.
Okay.
So, all right. Well, that's cool. That's cool. In his conversation with Poe, you know, he's talking about the princess and how, you know, she'll always be royalty to me or something like that. So that makes sense. Will Princess Leia be in Rogue One?
That's interesting. Well, if we're going by the theories that I just mentioned, she does appear in season two of Rebels. Right. So it is possible that she appears in Rogue One as well.
Rumors they had Carrie Fisher's daughter doing some scenes as Princess Leia.
Well, she appears in Force Awakens. She appears in the background of one of the scenes.
Right, and I thought she maybe had a bigger scene that was cut, or maybe not. But yeah, she's like walking up, like behind Carrie Fisher in one of the scenes. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. Well, I mean, it's possible. I I mean, I did hear, like you mentioned, that she had filmed a lot more than what actually appears. So maybe that's their way of saying that she did some of the pre-production in Rogue One, or as you're saying, that she's actually going to play a younger version of Leia.
Right. Interesting stuff. Cool. So let's get back to metal, to hard rock. Who have you been listening to lately, Victor?
I've been listening to a few different things. I think this year is really shaping up to be a great, great year for hard rock and metal. A lot of strong albums have come out. I've been really playing the Last in Line album a lot. Really enjoying that. Really enjoying the new album by The Cult. I think it's, out of this trilogy that they've released, it's probably the strongest of the three albums. Probably the most rock-centric out of the three. And as usual, I'm really enjoying the new Prong album. So
right.
Those three are my favorite so far.
Okay, cool. And who's in Prong now?
It's still Tommy Victor. This is the first album in a while where he's actually had the same lineup, quote-unquote, for two albums. This lineup didn't record the last album because the last two albums he's come across people that that have pretty much played multiple instruments. So it's been him and basically someone else. But this time around, he has kept or he's brought his touring band in to record this album. They've done they did the covers album that came out last year, and they've done this original album. And the two members are Jason Christopher and Art Cruz. And okay. I know that they were part of other known touring acts. So
right. So Monty Pittman isn't involved anymore?
He hasn't been involved in the last two albums. Last time that I did interview Tommy Victor, he did sort of mention off air that Monty and him are great friends, and that Monty still has, you know, a decent amount of input regarding the new material and whatnot. He always like sort of bounces things off of him, and that's funny that you bring up Monty, because I think his solo album, I mean, ever since that album has come out, I've listened to it on a very a frequent basis. So I actually listened to it.
When did that come out?
That came out, I believe it maybe 2 years ago at this point.
Okay. Cool. And have you hit any shows? Do you have, like, over where you are in Spain, do you have a town or city by you where there's frequent shows happening?
The closest is Bilbao, which is about an hour away. The last show that I've seen was, or the last show I saw was, I think, back in November. Right. I haven't been to a lot just because of all the various projects that I'm working on and trying to get off the ground. So between that and kids, it pretty much takes up all my time. So
right on. Cool. And it's been great having you back on this episode. I hope you can join us again soon. And we're definitely going to encourage all the Talking Metal listeners to check out Mars Attacks and Galaxy of Geeks. And what guests are coming up on Mars Attacks? Anybody in the can that we should know about?
Yeah, I have a bunch of different things that should be coming out within the next few weeks. Everyone from former Overkill guitarist Bobby Gustafson to the band Toxic. Steve Smythe, who was the guitarist in Testament and Nevermore. He has another band called One Machine. I have an interview with him that'll be out shortly as well, and a bunch of other things. Max Portnoy from from Next to None. His father's obviously Mike.
Right, cool.
And there's close to 20 interviews that I have in the can that should be coming out shortly. And
wow.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, I've been dealing with server issues, and it really didn't make sense for me to upload any of these interviews until everything was sort of set into place. And now that everything seems to be working fine, I'm going to slowly start to roll everything out. So
cool. All right, guys. Well, we're going to end with a song called Shy Boy, written by Billy Sheehan. I thought it was appropriate, being that Carl and I were talking about Scientology. Billy is a Scientologist, and I will go on record with saying he's also one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and I got to hang out with him for almost a whole day, a little less than a year ago, and just such a sweetheart, such a great guy, and such an incredible, incredible bass player, Billy Sheehan. This is Shy Boy off of the Eat 'Em and Smile record by David Lee Roth, featuring Billy Sheehan on bass, of course Steve Vai on guitar, Greg Bissonette on drums. Here we go, Shy Boy.
Numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.